Good evening. Thank you for joining the Medical Ethics Society and Pre-Med Club for this event entitled Obamacare, The Enigma Unveiled, a practical, ethical, and halachic analysis of the Affordable Care Act.
My name is Isaac Dreyfus.
And I'm Connie Herzig.
And I'm Chaim Shaftel.
Hi. And on behalf of the... And on behalf of Yeshiva University's Medical Ethics Society and the Pre-Med Club, thank you for coming.
Whether as a provider or a consumer, healthcare affects every one of us. And we organized tonight's event in the hopes that we can shed some light on the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare.
Just like to thank a few people and offices who made this event possible. The Medical Ethics Society, along with the presidents Mordechai and Yosefa, the volunteers who helped out and saw this all the way through, some of the offices, the Office of Student Life, YSU, SCWSC, and all the clubs and societies who co-sponsored this evening. Thank you very much. And last but not least, we're fortunate to have with us three experts, and we'd like to thank them all for their time and contributions.
Our first speaker is Dr. Kevin O'Halloran. Dr. O'Halloran is a senior resident at the Montefiore Department of Orthopedic Surgery. He receives his MD from Georgetown University School of Medicine. He recently published an article along with his colleagues on the Accountable Care Organizations, which is one facet of the Affordable Care Act. In his spare time, Dr. O'Halloran enjoys long walks on the beach with his girlfriend, and he also enjoys orange soda. Dr. O'Halloran.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I appreciate the invite, and it's an honor to speak. I'm going to go through things. I have some notes I'm going to refer to here. I hope this is somewhat polished. I'm going to talk to you basically about the details of the Obamacare Act. I'm going to leave it to these gentlemen to my left to explain more of the nuances of it. Thankfully, I just have to tell you what it is. Some of the things that we covered is what I was asked to speak on is the core principles of the Accountable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act, how it will affect the practice of medicine, how patients will be affected by its policies. Some of the things I'm not going to cover are the financial aspects behind it in terms of how it's going to be funded. That's a bit detailed of a topic. Whenever I'm asked to speak on any topic, especially when it's to college-age adults, I know that I'm dealing with Wikipedia and attention spans and smartphones, so I'll try to make this as fast as possible and try to come up with a synthesis of ideas that you wouldn't really be able to get by just looking this up online. So. The first thing is, I'm a big fan of history, so whenever I talk about where we are now, it's 2012, we're in New York City, we're talking about healthcare reform, I like to talk about how we got here, basically what in American medicine, what in the United States has brought us to this point. And so you can start with sort of any point in medicine in the United States, but I decided to start with the death of our first president on December 14th in 1799. And so It's interesting that this when General Washington got sick this night, he was attended by three physicians. Two of them, the senior physicians, advocated for bleeding and for lower bowel laxatives, which is interesting because the president was having difficulty breathing. Most experts agree that he died of something called bacterial epiglottitis, which is an infection by H. influenza, something that's very rare these days because of the vaccine. The junior most doctor, Dr. Elisha Dick, came, and he actually asked them to stop doing the bleeding. They agreed with him on that, and they ceased the bleeding. And he advocated for a tracheotomy. The tracheotomy would have actually more than likely saved the general's life. It would have been rather painful, considering there wasn't anesthesia in those days and there weren't antibiotics. But unfortunately, he was denied the opportunity to do the tracheotomy. The president died later that day. This is a painting by Junius Stearns of that scene. So in looking at, we kind of look at where medicine was in 1799 in America. There was really limited physician income. Competition was very high, not just among physicians, but among lay practitioners, folk medicine practitioners, and just healthcare in the home, this home care. There was very little political clout. No one really respected physicians. They, for obvious purposes, when you get called for respiratory difficulty and you bleed someone, it's unlikely that people are going to really respect you. There's very little oversight at that time of any sort of medical education. There weren't board exams. There were lax licensing laws, little oversight. By 1830, things actually got worse, which is hard to imagine, but most of the states that had any sort of licensing laws had repealed them. The self-treatment became much more common. There was no real sense of any sort of, I guess, intellectual base to the field. At this point, shortly after, about 30 years after, we came to the Civil War, and the medical community was incapable of dealing with this level of casualties. It is interesting to look at these two photos. On the bottom right is a amputation kit that a Union Army surgeon would have used. On the left is what looks like a demo photograph of an amputation. I'm saying this just because the gentleman's leg looks to be rather healthy. I'm hoping they weren't planning on actually amputating that. The interesting thing about this photo is that you're starting to see some of the changes in medicine from looking here. The gentleman at the head of the patient looks to be an anesthesiologist of some sort. He has what look like soaked rags. Those would often be soaked in chloroform as sort of the onset of anesthesia. So that was where we first start to see medicine changing. So shortly before the war, the American Medical Association was formed. It was formed in 1847. Initially, it was a very small organization, and it gained clout. By the time 1910 rolled around, about 50% of physicians in the United States were members. It instituted basically standards for medical schools. It closed underperforming medical schools. Medical schools decreased the amount of students that they were admitting so as to decrease competition. And they basically enhanced the licensing at state levels. Also, simultaneous to this, there were a number of medical advances. So these are sort of some highlights of medical advances. The germ theory of disease. So no one had any idea what was causing these infections. And this is in the mid-1800s when people first started talking about germ theory of disease. In 1867, Joseph Lister in England came up with antisepsis. He didn't really know what he was killing, but he put carbolic acid on wounds, and it made things better. By 1900, the idea of asepsis, which was doing sterile techniques. So by then, they knew the germs were causing disease, and they decided to start doing clean surgery. 1846, the first use of rudimentary anesthesia. Unfortunately, by the Civil War, that wasn't really widely used, but it existed. And the second half of the 1800s saw pretty significant increases in surgery in terms of surgical techniques. That was largely brought about by anesthesia. You can imagine if you had a non-anesthetized patient, you wanted your surgery to be done very quickly, and you weren't necessarily worried about technique, you just got it done. When you had anesthesia, you had time to actually get much better at it, you were able to do a much more careful job, and people started surviving very complicated surgeries. In 1895, the invention of the X-ray, that helped bring about my field. Dr. Röntgen in Germany, he decided, I guess always the chivalrous sort, he decided to X-ray his wife. So that's the first human X-ray there of his wife's hand. And all of this combination of factors between the AMA with its licensing and regulation of medical schools and all of these advances started to lead to allopathic medicine outpacing the other forms of treatment that existed at the time, and brought a bit of political clout to medical care and to physicians. So that's what sort of brought medicine out of the dark ages, if you will, and into being more of a respected field. In the 1850s, it was cheap. So you could get a doctor's visit for $2. If the guy came at night, it was $3. You probably should have just saved your money, because judging from what they could do, it really wasn't so much. You might have well just kept your home health guide and taken care of it. Some of the cost aspects. So the American Medical Association advocated a fee-for-service type of payment for physicians. What this means is essentially the physician billed for everything. So if they did an injection, they billed for that. If they opened the skin for a surgical procedure, they billed for that. When they closed the skin, they billed for that. It was actually a very lucrative way to make money, and it persists to this day in a large aspect of the medical community. This, as we discussed already, increased technology led to increased cost. And this increased cost led to the first time where people started having difficulty paying for their medical care. Most people could come up with $2 in 1850 to have a doctor's visit. By the time they were talking about significantly more expenses near the end of the century, in Europe they discussed social insurance bills and actually passed them in Germany and in Britain. The first time this came to light in the United States was in the 1912 presidential campaign. Teddy Roosevelt, so he'd already been president before, he elected to not run for a second term, deferred to President Taft. President Taft and him had some disagreements, and Teddy decided to run again in 1912. In the interim, Teddy was he's a smart guy, but I don't think he thought this up on his own. He really, his conversations with this gentleman, so this is sort of the unknown father of healthcare reform in the United States. Dr. Rubinow came from a Russian Jewish family. He emigrated to the United States when he was 18. He got an MD from NYU and practiced medicine on the Lower East Side for about 5 years. He spent a lot of time with indigent populations, and eventually decided that his best way to help his patients was to actually improve their status economically rather than medically, which is sort of an interesting thought for all of those who are thinking of medicine. He published a book called Social Insurance in 1913. He'd published previously on basically the ideas behind national health care, and he had spent quite a bit of time discussing this with Teddy Roosevelt. He was instrumental in the workmen's compensation legislation, and later he would be instrumental in the Social Security Act. Unfortunately, things didn't work out so well for Dr. Rubino's legislation nor Teddy Roosevelt, who lost the election. The legislation that Dr. Rubino proposed in 1915 and got into the Congress by 1916 was kind of getting batted around in the U.S. Congress. And if you recall your history, in 1916, Germany wasn't so popular, and unfortunately this bill was very closely tied to Germany. It was modeled off the German bill in 1883, and so the opponents of this bill really just had to say, do you want something that came out of Germany when we're at war with them? And that was the end of that bill. So the bill ended in 1917. Dr. Rubino attempted to, and his organization, attempted to pass legislation from 1915 to 1920 in state by state, and those unfortunately all failed. California was very close but didn't quite make it. Roosevelt in 1935 attempted to pass the Social Security Act with national health insurance. That failed. The Social Security Act passed, but not with national health insurance. In the 40s and 50s, Harry Truman, after the war, attempted to pass a national health insurance bill. In 1974, Richard Nixon's comprehensive health insurance plan failed. That Watergate didn't look so great for him, so that was the end of that. President Clinton's Health Care Security Act failed in 93. So, failure. essentially, we have a long list of failure in health care reform in the United States. Some may say that's a good thing, some may say it's a bad thing. We'll hear about some of that later, but we do have reform that actually passed. So, in 1930, President Hoover passed the VA bill. So Veterans Administration is really the first national health insurance, if you will, for a certain subset of the population. In 1965, President Johnson and President Kennedy's Medicare and Medicaid bill. Kennedy had introduced it. Johnson carried it through to completion after Kennedy's assassination. I'm going to go through some of the details of these bills because they're important for what we talk about later with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. In 97, President Clinton passed SCHIP, or known as CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, Medicare Part C. 86, Reagan passed COBRA. In 2003, President Bush's Medicare Modernization Act, the Part D Medicare, and obviously what we're here to talk about today, 2010, President Obama's Obamacare. So in discussing, coming back to the Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare is a federally funded program, meaning that there's some nuance to that. So Part A is a federally funded program. This is hospital insurance for everyone over 65. It also covers people who have end-stage renal disease and people with disabilities for more than 2 years. Part A is essentially free of charge to senior citizens. However, it covers not everything. So if you have a very particularly bad year in terms of your health, you will still have some out-of-pocket expenses, but not nearly as much as you would have if you were paying, obviously, completely out-of-pocket. Part B is largely a state-run part of the Medicare plan, and it's outpatient. So it's essentially out-of-hospital care, and it's run by premiums. So you basically pay a premium. The federal government and the state split some of the expenses, and that covers you for your outpatient aspects of Medicare. You'll see in 97 the SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So the Children's Health Insurance Program would be more, we would say, on sort of the liberal side of the political spectrum. That was something that expanded Medicaid. And so Medicaid is this bill that covers you for anyone who's really at the federal poverty line and below, 100% of federal poverty and below. And that bill is largely also run by the states. The SCHIP increased that, so a little bit more than the 100%. However, to get that bill passed, Clinton had to compromise. And so Medicare Part C is something that would be more from the conservative side, which is a little bit of a privatization of Medicare, which means that you link together Part A and Part B under a private insurer that gets a subsidy from the federal government. So just I want you guys to know about these. I'm sorry, it's a little bit esoteric, but just to have an idea where we're going for later. President Reagan's COBRA Act, this is the first time that anyone had legislated an aspect of a bill where you could actually continue to have insurance after you got fired or laid off from work. So if you were to If you were to leave work in 1985, you really couldn't continue your insurance. You'd be on your own trying to find insurance on the economy. In this case, you could now continue to have your insurance from work, but you had to pay the bill yourself, and you had to pay all of it. Not your employer's contribution was no longer obviously paid by your employer, and you were off taking care of it on your own. President Bush's Medicare Modernization Act, this is Medicare, often known as Medicare Part D, this covers prescriptions. So essentially, all of the previous Medicare and Medicaid bills didn't cover prescriptions. This is the first time where prescriptions are covered. There's a bit of a controversy with this, mainly because there's what's called a donut hole, which means you spend about $3,000 worth of prescriptions in a year, that's covered. After that, you're on your own for about $3,000, and then the rest of it gets covered. So if you're a senior and you only spend $3,000 a year on medications, you're great. If you spend $6,000, half that comes out of your own pocket. And so some of what Obamacare does is attempt to rectify that. And I say attempt because I'm still a little bit doubtful about the money issues, but that's something we'll, like I said, we'll discuss. All right, so setting the stage for healthcare reform in 2010, where were we at as a country? The Census Bureau estimated that 50 million people were without insurance. That's 16% of the population. The Kaiser Family Foundation talked about $15,000 a year for a family plan for insurance. 4,000 of that often came out of the employer's contribution. The World Health Organization, basically, we are by far the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We spend $7,100 a year per American in 2008. That's much more. I think it's about $8,200 as of my last numbers on the article that we just published. The Commonwealth Fund in 2010 ranked the U.S. seventh behind a whole bunch of countries like New Zealand and Britain and other countries we shouldn't really be behind. But in terms of the accessibility of medical care in the United States and the outcomes of patients. So the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was enacted by the 111th Congress. It was signed by President Obama in March of 2010, and it's considered the most significant regulatory overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system since Medicaid. So what it is, and this is the reason why we're going to talk about it in sort of sparing details, because it has 10 titles. There's 2,407 pages. I didn't read them all. I never have. I don't think anyone has. Even your Congress people probably haven't read it all, even though they signed it. I don't think President Obama probably read it all, and he signed it. There are, maybe he should have. There are really too many provisions to assess all of them. We'll cover the stuff that we talked about before. So core principles, how it will affect physician pay, and policies. These are the titles. Interestingly, sort of just like anything in the government before it got off the ground, Title VII has already been nixed. It's the Secretary of Health and Human Services said that it's not financially viable and it will not be put into place. So we're going to talk about new insurance options that are available for patients, new rights and provisions for patients, mandatory insurance changes, and sort of various population subsets and how the bill will affect them. First of all, rights and provisions. So a summary of benefits and coverage is something that's going to be required of every private insurance company. Something to stop and that I forgot to mention, this is important to talk about what Obamacare is. It doesn't tear down any aspect of American medical care now. It doesn't take away private insurance. It doesn't take away Medicare. It doesn't take away the VA. It really builds on what we already have. Some people say that's a good idea. Some people say it's not. I'm going to leave that for you guys to decide. But what it does is it's almost like a patch, like Microsoft when they send out their patches. You're building on top of something that already exists. So a lot of it are legislative mandates and regulations for insurance companies that already exist. They're not making something new. They are essentially forcing them to do some things. So a summary of benefits and coverage is going to be required on the online sites for all of these insurance companies. Consumer assistance programs. So in every state there will be either a consumer assistance program or some semblance of that run by the state. This is sort of a 1-800 number you can call when things go wrong with your insurance, and you can also appeal healthcare decisions. So as of currently right now, what happens a lot in our clinics is an insurance company will deny, say, an MRI, and we really don't have any recourse. Neither the patient has recourse nor we have recourse. We can call the insurance company. If they say no, that's sort of where it ends. We don't have anywhere we can go. This is something that basically the federal government or the state government, depending on each state is running this differently, it'll have a clearinghouse where you can go and you can talk to them in the hopes of getting them to help. Preventive care without deductibles. This is a very large part of the bill. There are a whole number, too many to go into, but preventative care options that will be available now without any sort of deductible. You can go, you get your care, you don't have to pay a copay, you don't have to pay any sort of deductible, it doesn't come out of your yearly deductible. There'll be no restrictions on ER choice. This is interesting. So everything in this bill, you have to read very closely into. So that sounds great, right? You can go to any ER. Say I walk out of here and I have some sort of colon issue and I have to go to the ER right down the street. I go there, fine. My health care plan will pay basically what their own ER would have charged. So even though it says that you can go to any ER and it says that you won't be charged a copay or deductible, you still have to pay whatever the difference is in that cost. So if the ER you decide to go to is, say, NYU's ER or HSS, or, well, HSS doesn't have an ER, but that's a separate issue, you essentially still end up paying. So every one of these little rules you have to look and take with a bit of a grain of salt. No referrals to see an OB-GYN, so previously a lot of insurance plans required you to go to a primary care doctor before you could see an OB-GYN. You no longer have to do that. Insurance cancellations for errors or accidental omissions. So if you forget to put that you saw a psychiatrist a couple of times when you were in high school, if you forgot to put that you broke your ankle when you were 4, that's not going to take away it's not going to take away your insurance when something else comes up. So if your insurance company digs up something from your past when you have an expensive medical care issue, they're no longer going to be able to find a reason to cancel you by saying that you were dishonest on your application. There'll be increased coverage, as we talked about, for preventive care, and then there's grandfathered health plans. One of the big things that the president talked about when he was pushing this bill was that if you like your insurance, we're not going to take it away from you, which is also not exactly true. We're not going to take it away from you until 2014. So, till 2014, your grandfathered health plan, whatever you were on, is fine. In 2014, things are going to start changing. It's basically going to mean that by 2014, everything is going to come under this rubric, and if your plan before offered you X, Y, and Z, they may not offer that anymore after 2014 because they won't be able to afford to. So there'll be certainly some changes, even though they say that your plan will stay the same. So in terms of insurance choices, there's a few things. So they tried to cover some of the gaps that the American insurance basically plans don't necessarily always cover. Pre-existing condition. So if you have a pre-existing condition and you find yourself uninsured, it's very difficult to find insurance. If you've had cancer, say you had leukemia when you were in high school and now you're trying to find insurance, good luck. Luckily, one of the good things about this bill is that you can find insurance. So the pre-existing condition insurance plan will cover you up until 2014. In 2014, it becomes illegal for any insurance company to deny you based on any sort of pre-existing condition. Obviously, that's going to change the financial dynamics in the insurance world, and probably the premiums, but they'll no longer be able to deny you. Young adult coverage, so if you're up to 26 years old, you can be on your parents' plan. That's something that's new and different. These insurance exchanges in 2014. So I can talk about this briefly. Unfortunately, there's very little information discussing exactly how these are going to work. States are scrambling to put these into place, especially a lot of the states that typically vote for Republicans, because they weren't expecting them to have to do it. They thought that if Romney won, it was going to be that this whole bill was not going to come into play. And now that these insurance exchanges are actually going to have to come into play in 2014, a lot of states are scrambling to put these together. And there's really pretty little written about how they're going to work or whether they're going to work. Some of it sounds a little bit suspect. Cooperative insurance, this is sort of just an interesting aside. If you didn't like the insurance options you saw presented to you, you could actually make your own. Typically, an individual would make your own, but nonprofits could actually form their own. They can petition the government for a loan to make their own insurance, and they can form an insurance group. Obviously, there's a lot of oversight of this, and the feds are going to watch you closely, but you can do that. There's still time. December 12th of this year is the last time to turn that in, so if you're interested in making your own insurance, you can go ahead and get that together quickly. Medicaid eligibility increased up to 133% of the poverty line in most states. 5 states elected not to take part in that. I don't think we should necessarily judge those states as somehow harshly. They all made their decision, not necessarily a political decision, but because the government mandates that you have to increase your Medicaid eligibility doesn't mean they're going to pay for all of that update. And so it does mean that a state that accepts this rate is going to have to pony up some of the money also. And so the states that elected not to take part in this, New York elected to take part in it, but the states that didn't were not necessarily, I don't think we should necessarily judge them harshly. SCHIP, so the Children's Health Insurance Program, basically the enrollment was facilitated. So they improved the ability to enroll in that. These are some more mandatory insurance changes. So medical loss ratio, this is an interesting aspect. This is going to tie insurance's hands a little bit in terms of being able to make profits at the same level as before. 80% is what they have to spend on medical expenses. Only 20% will be allowed to be kept for premiums and for profits and for, excuse me, for profits and for administrative overhead, and 85% for plans that are for businesses. So 80% can be spent as though it's, if I buy my own plan, my insurance company has to spend 80% of my premium dollars on medical care. Now, not necessarily for my medical care, because what if I don't get sick that year? But in general, the aggregate expenditures have to be 80% for medical care and only 20% for administrative overhead. That's different than what we typically see in terms of the numbers of what insurance spends now. Some insurance, the medical loss ratio is 50%, some 65%. So there's going to be some changes in terms of how insurance companies have to run things. If they don't have, if this medical loss ratio is not abided by, they actually have to give a rebate to their clients. So it's something that we'll certainly see some changes in the next few years. There are no lifetime limits on benefits now. So it used to be that a lot of insurance plans would say you can have up to $1 million, and after $1 million, you know, you're done. That's gone. There'll be no annual or lifetime limits starting in 2014. So this is interesting because we see this a lot, especially in a traumatic field in orthopedics. You know, people think, well, $1 million, that's a lot. Well, if you run your motorcycle into the side of a UPS truck and you're in the ICU for 6 months and you've got 15 surgeries, you're at $2 or $3 million very quickly. So it's something that, you know, is not a trivial aspect of this bill. Rate review. So this is sort of interesting. Any insurance company that wants to raise its rates greater than 10% at any time will have to justify that to the public, and will have to justify it to the government. And if the government decides that it's unjustified in terms of its rate increase, they can actually veto it. I think it's interesting that it's 10%, because I guess you could just put it at 9.5% and just keep doing that annually, and no one to really ask any questions. However, you're still kind of tied by the top part, which is you still have to spend 80% of it on medical care. So they kind of have them coming and going in terms of the plan. So we're going to talk about just some subsets of population. So women. So women that are not eligible for Medicare. So there's a whole bunch of preventative services that are no longer, they're now covered. No more co-payments, no more deductibles. A lot of these, so just about any vaccine, including the new ones, osteoporosis screening, domestic violence, sort of, you can see the list here. We don't have to read through everything. FDA-approved contraceptives is sort of a controversial one. Breastfeeding support, UTI testing, just sort of everything. And then also expanded Medicaid eligibility in all but the 5 states that refused the increase in federal funding. So looking at pregnant women, women with children, health plans. So as of bill passage, health plans can no longer refuse anyone for pre-existing medical conditions who's under 19. In 2014, they can't refuse anybody. But right now, immediately went into effect that anyone under age 19 cannot have their insurance refused for any pre-existing medical conditions. Maternity care is interestingly not covered under all insurance plans, so you may have an insurance plan that does not cover maternity care. So you get pregnant, and suddenly you find that you have to pay for all of your prenatal care, you have to pay for the birthing process, and that will also change in 2014. And then, as we discussed, the reduced burden for CHIP. So for families, there'll be tax credits to offset premiums for sort of middle-class families. 400% of the poverty line is $88,000 a year for a family of four. So if you make up to that point, that sort of income, which is a large swath of the country, you'll qualify for tax credits. These tax credits are interesting in the sense that this hasn't been seen yet, but the IRS will actually send you checks during the year to help offset your premium payments instead of just having to wait till April 15th in terms of getting your rebate. I don't know if that's going to happen. I'm curious to see the IRS sending me a check, but we'll see how it goes. So, and this is for small business owners. So tax credits of 35% to 50% for cost of purchasing insurance. So if you have less than 25 employees, this is something that can certainly help you with being able to pay for insurance. Obviously, you see that still 50% of that you have to come up with. In 2014, you'll be able to apply for grants to cover your early retirees. So it used to be that early retirees, the premiums were very high and it was difficult. So if you're 55 and you're retired, you're not yet eligible for Medicare. It can be very expensive to find insurance on the economy, on the private market. And now you can actually get some grants from the government to help with that. So this is that insurance exchanges that we were discussing. Supposedly will obviate the need for these policies. It's going to the idea behind these insurance exchanges is the competition of the exchanges are going to make the insurance companies have to bid lower to attract clients, and it will allow companies to be able to afford to insure their employees. Like I said, very little written about this and very little evidence to prove that that's necessarily going to work, so that's something to kind of stay tuned for. People over 65, this is a big part of the bill. So strengthening Medicare. This is anyone who's on Medicare and had Part B, that was the one we earlier discussed, that is it's an outpatient aspect of the insurance. It means you pay a premium and you pay co-payments and deductibles as if you were someone under 65 and had private insurance. Certain things here in this list are now going to be covered without any sort of co-payment, without any sort of deductible. The big thing at the bottom here is progressively discounted drugs through Part D. That means that the donut hole that we were discussing, that $3,000 window of medication payment, is going to be closed by 2020. I'm actually glad that we're not going into depth in the finances, mainly because there isn't really time, but this is going to be hard to do. The President Bush's 2003 bill was extremely expensive, and this is going to make it even more expensive. So this is basically saying the government is going to take on the responsibility of paying for essentially all of the medications for all Medicare patients, and that's a lot of money. I'm curious to see exactly how that's going to work. So you guys asked me to talk about, will physician pay be affected? It's a very hard question. The short answer that I put here is yes. Pay will be different for physicians. It's going to be different depending on the specialty. It's going to be different depending on what kind of hospital you're affiliated with, or if you're affiliated with a hospital at all. Essentially, depending on your specialty and depending on how you deal with this law will depend on whether your pay goes up, down, stays the same. There are changes to Medicare that really have, I put here a ripple effect, or basically that have this effect throughout the entire industry. So when Medicare makes changes to its insurance industry, that passes to the private insurance companies. They look at what Medicare does. When Medicare does things that work, they implement the same things. Medicare, with this bill, is trying about 20 different new payment systems and initiatives. The main point of it is this. They're looking at something called value-based purchasing. So this is something that I recently published on, is the idea behind Medicare deciding to purchase healthcare based on value rather than volume. So since 1965, volume has been what they've done. I do a surgery, I bill for it, I get my payment. If my patient does well, great. If my patient doesn't do so hot, I still get paid. What Medicare is looking to do is to institute a policy that looks at the outcome of patients and whether or not physicians, hospitals, rehab centers are actually improving the health of their patients. And depending on that improvement, they will be paid and compensated accordingly. This is the first, and like I said, there's 20 of these. I'm not going to go into all of them. I'm going to take some of the highlights. So this is what's called value-based purchasing, the hospital value-based purchasing program. Medicare shaved 1% off of its payments to everyone across the board and instituted this $850 million incentive program. 3,500 hospitals nationwide are competing to follow these clinical practices that we sort of know of as very good clinical practices and enhancing the patient's experience of care. There's about seven guidelines that they're going to be judged on. This stuff is going to be available online, especially starting in 2014. You'll be able to see basically the grades of these hospitals, and they will get reimbursed accordingly. They'll get to take some of that pool of $850 million. That amount is going to increase. So every year, Medicare is going to take a little bit more off of that. That they took 1%, they're going to take another percent and another percent as they move towards really paying for value instead of for volume. So ACOs are another aspect. This is really one of the really big aspects of this bill that they think is going to account for how they're going to be able to pay for all of this. So a lot of this value-based purchasing is what Medicare and what the federal government is banking on as reducing costs to the point that it's going to be able to finance this entire bill. Whether that's going to work or not, I'm not entirely sure. The ACOs, which Einstein and Montefiore are one of the, in fact, the only pioneer ACO, which I'm going to discuss what that means, but in New York. And what this means is ACOs are accountable care organizations. They basically take they take control of 5,000 Medicare patients or more. In Montefiore's aspect, I think it's 25,000 Medicare patients, original Medicare patients, and they attempt to streamline medical care. So, to give sort of an example of this, if you can imagine, you see your cardiologist, but your cardiologist isn't affiliated with Einstein. Your cardiologist recommends X, Y, and Z test. You get a, for some reason you get an echocardiogram because your cardiologist recommended it. Unfortunately, you fall a couple days later and you come to my hospital with a hip fracture. Before you have your surgery, my cardiologist see you and they recommend an echocardiogram. Well, you tell me, well, you already had your echocardiogram, but we don't really have access to that echocardiogram. I can't see that echocardiogram, I can't see the results of it. Perhaps it's 3 a.m. and your cardiologist isn't around. The idea behind an ACO is to circumvent those problems, to look at these problems, to figure out where they are, and try to do something about it. Is there a way we can access that particular cardiologist? If that cardiologist sees a lot of our patients, is there a way we can get that cardiologist system uploaded in our system so we can see his echocardiograms or her echocardiograms? Is there a way that we can get a hold of someone from that office, even if it is 3 a.m., and find out, basically, do we need to do another echocardiogram, or do we already have those results? Because what they're looking at is a lot of duplicative care. Are we duplicating what we're doing for these patients, and in some cases even potentially causing them harm? If an echocardiogram doesn't cause harm, but there are a number of tests that you can do that if you have to repeat them, every time you repeat them, you're putting the patient at risk in addition to costing a lot of money. The reason why hospitals get into this, hospitals don't do a lot for necessarily, despite them being a place where people go to get better, they're not always altruistic, so they get money out of this. So they share in the savings. So if Medicare's costs go down, the ACO will basically make money. So a percentage of that savings will be reimbursed to the hospital. This is just sort of some details. All it means that a pioneer ACO is it means sort of, an ACO that's got a little bit more courage. They're willing to take more risk. So, and this means that they're also willing to get more gain. So, Montefiore has spent quite a bit of time and energy putting together a sort of cohesive, streamlined aspect to its medical care, and therefore felt that it had a little bit more courage in terms of when these ACOs came out to sign up for this pioneer ACO where they get a higher percentage of the savings if they manage to save. And so, what Medicare does. The other thing is, it's not all just beneficial things. It's also a little bit of punishment. So they say hospitals that have high readmission rates, they're going to start charging them. In 2015, hospitals without information technology are going to start getting charged. Physician payments are going to change. These are some things, just other ways that physicians are being paid. There'll be more well patient visits. So if you're a primary care doctor, it's likely that you're going to get more income. ACOs also apply to primary care, so primary care doctors can get involved in the same thing. So really, a lot of this comes down to the primary care doctor is going to do pretty well. Unfortunately, my field and others may not do quite as well. Specialists might not do quite as well in this new bill. People talk about penalties, so everyone wanted to hear about the penalty. You heard you have to have insurance or you get a penalty, and that's true. So for most groups, there are a few exceptions. If you're in prison, you don't have to have insurance. If you're in the military, you don't have to have insurance. That's something that's already covered. But your penalty would be 2.5% of your taxable income above the taxable threshold. So if you make $50,000, you'll be penalized on $40,000 a year. And then everyone talked about the death panel. So this was a section 1233 of House Resolution 3200. This was taken out. So that's not in there. But basically, it was a discussion about reimbursing physicians for end of life care. That's been struck from the final bill. So what Obamacare is, it's a major overhaul of the healthcare financing system. It leaves in place most of the current system. It's expected to extend coverage to a lot of folks, but not all of them. It's controversial, it's complex. It is not the end of healthcare reform. All of us will see more healthcare reform in our lifetimes. It doesn't matter if you're 70 years old or if you're 7 years old, you're gonna see healthcare reform in your lifetime. It's still gonna happen. It's difficult to call Obamacare socialized medicine. If you look at this, is the Merriam-Webster definition of socialized medicine. It's basically where the state essentially controls everything. Obamacare is really partially funded by taxes and subsidies, partially run by private contributions, and partially run by the state. Essentially the physicians will still be private, the hospitals will still be private. What is really socialized about American medicine? Veterans Administration, Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP. What does Obamacare fail to do? It does not address long-term care insurance. So if you get put in the nursing home, It's something we're not going to go into just because we don't have the time, but it does not talk about that. It doesn't solve the uninsured crisis. In 2019, there's still going to be 23 million Americans without insurance. Undocumented immigrants, if you're undocumented in this country, you do not get insurance. So there you go. Any questions? Thank you.
No, it's great. Thank you for that very thorough presentation. Okay, now we're going to hear from Dr. Herb Leventer about the ethics of Obamacare. I'm just going to introduce you. Dr. Herb Leventer received his PhD from Columbia, and in addition to other ethical topics, such as ethics of war and environmental ethics, he's a professor of healthcare reform at NYU and medical ethics at Stern. Thank you, Dr. Leventer.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for coming out. I was given an unusual job of both defending and attacking the healthcare reform. Apparently, the sponsors had difficulty finding somebody to point out what was wrong with Obamacare, so I'm going to do both. Since I don't think there's very much wrong with Obamacare, this is difficult, but I'll try, and you'll see how it works out. I guess we'll stop for questions after each section. Okay. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, bears little resemblance to the cliches by which its opponents have described it. It is bipartisan. For a year, Republicans actively participated in its drafting, adding hundreds of amendments and close to 1,000 pages to the original 600-page document that the Democrats proposed. It's the opposite of a government takeover of health care. It channels almost all of its reforms through the 50 states, and it encourages private physician initiatives to create innovative demonstration projects to test better ways of delivering health care. It's not a job killer. Quite the contrary, it funds the expansion of the health care workforce from the present 15 million people, presumably by at least a million. For those of you who are not familiar with the numbers, there's about 800,000 MDs in the United States. There's about 3 million nurses in the United States. The other 12 million are various allied health professionals, nurse practitioners, social work, PT, speech therapy, and so on. And technicians, radiology techs, and frankly, anybody who works in a hospital, like the guy who mops up the OR floor. Well, if you're going to have a lot more people insured, about 32 million by 2020, you're going to be providing a lot more health care, which means you're going to need more people. So it's creating lots of jobs, and there are very many specific features in the health care reform bill which fund the creation of new jobs. Federal money to nursing schools to increase enrollment, federal money to medical schools to increase the number of slots, and so on. The goal is not to create more MDs, only a small number will be created, but rather to create more healthcare professionals. Healthcare professionals, often called, I hate this term, but everybody uses it, physician extenders, nurses, physician assistants, social workers, and various technicians. These are the people who are really going to be gaining by it. So if you're in PT or OT, your future is all the way up. The purpose of the Obamacare is not simply to expand coverage to the poor, although of course it does that. Rather, it is an integrated attempt to solve four major problems in our current healthcare system: high cost, poor access, unfairness in distributing cost and access, and a fourth problem that's not universally recognized: poor quality, or at least inferior health outcomes compared to the other industrialized countries of the world. We do provide the best health care in the world. That's why so many oil sheikhs come to our medical centers. But we provide it only to those who have lots of money or good insurance. And about half of our country, 47% is not a bad estimate, has neither money nor good coverage. Incidentally, Obamacare does not try to solve all problems. For instance, it does nothing to increase payments to physicians who take Medicare and Medicaid patients.
they get only a percentage of standard fees. Or more broadly, it doesn't change or solve one of the biggest problems in healthcare, that we don't have a healthcare system. We have, as you've just heard, a hodgepodge of poorly integrated systems, public and private, federal and state, single-payer Medicare, joint federal-state payer Medicaid, Medicare for old people, Medicaid for the deserving poor. Incidentally, one of the common misconceptions is that Medicaid is government medical care for poor people. It's explicitly not that. It's health care for children, pregnant women, and families, old people who have run out of money and can't afford to pay, for example, for their nursing home care, and disabled people. So if you have MS and you need a wheelchair, the government provides that wheelchair. Medicare is explicitly forbidden from providing medical care to unmarried adults. Several states have asked for waivers to allow coverage of young adults, of unmarried adults. One of the revolutionary things about Obamacare is that it makes Medicaid a real insurance for poor people. Anybody who makes less than 138% of the poverty level, which is a pitiful amount of money. The poverty level is about $11,000 a year for one person, $22,000 a year for a family of four. Nobody can live on that, really, in the United States in 2012. Well, if you make 138% of that, even if you don't have children, even if you're not pregnant, even if you're not disabled, you're just a regular old person who's flipping hamburgers at McDonald's, the first time that any government program helps you is Obama's Obamacare. Although it doesn't attempt to solve all these disorganization problems, as you've heard, it does provide incentives to encourage the different parts of our healthcare system to work together better and to coordinate care, so that if you go from one setting to another, you're not repeating the same tests and you're not getting subpar medical treatment. This ultimately will provide better health care for people and also save a great deal of money. Let me quickly go through the four problems and point out some of the ethical implications of each of those four problems. Cost. The United States spent last year $2.7 trillion on medical care, over 17% of gross national product. So what's wrong with that? Some societies spend even more of their gross domestic product building pyramids or armies. Health is surely a much more reasonable area for conspicuous consumption. But if we spend more than we have to, that means that there is less societal money to pay for other goods that social justice requires, like education, police force, firefighters, art, pollution control. The fact that every other advanced industrialized country in the world spends significantly less than we do is evidence that we're probably spending more than we have to. That is, we're wasting resources, which is per se immoral. Why are we spending so much and thus wasting resources? Frenchmen go to the doctor 50% as often as we do, and yet spend half as much on medical care as a country, per capita, of course. We have reason to hope that we can succeed in finding out why we spend so much money, because the actual number of people who consume most of that money is tiny. The statistic is 5% of the population spends half of total medical expenditures in the United States. 5% of our population is 15 million people. 300 million is a bit hard to analyze. 15 million is very doable. We can see how care is delivered to those 15 million people who are using up half of our medical resources, and perhaps figure out how to change that and save money. The main reason we spend so much is that much of medicine is wasteful. The often cited statistic, which is probably accurate, although clearly not provable, is that perhaps a third of all medical care is either useless or wasteful. For example, we perform three times as many coronary artery bypass procedures in the United States as does England or France. All these figures, of course, are per capita, so it doesn't matter what the actual population is. Three times as many bypasses, and yet we do not have a lower death rate for heart attacks. We have five times as many MRI machines as they do, with no better outcomes. A third of all births in the United States are by C-section, more than any other country, and yet the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology estimates that about half of them are medically necessary. Why are the other half being performed? It's not merely that they're twice as expensive as vaginal delivery, they're also harmful and dangerous to the mother. It's a major attack on the mother's body. Major surgery, which has a possibility of complications. Half of them unnecessary. We're talking, you know, there's 4 million births in the United States. And if 30% are by C-section and half of those are unnecessary C-sections, and the extra cost of a C-section over a vaginal delivery is about $10,000, $10,000, you can do the math yourself. This is an enormous amount of money. You can save billions of dollars with a single change. If only we could figure out which C-sections were unnecessary and not do them. Who wants an unnecessary surgery? We could begin saving real money. We used to do yearly Pap tests on women to check for a cervical cancer. We now know that you only have to do it every 2 years. You catch exactly as many cancers every 2 years as every 1 year. Nobody is hurt. Why do those extra tests? Pap smear is only $25. Who cares? There are, 150 million women in the United States. Even if it's only a few dollars that you're wasting, it builds up. Examples like this are behind the call for evidence-based medicine. That is, practicing only those medical procedures which are known to work, not just doing everything that you can, hoping that something sticks. The Affordable Care Act puts billions of dollars into supporting research to find out just what interventions work and which are necessary. And this is a very moral thing to do. Doctors are trained in academic medical centers, tertiary care hospitals, where they see the most challenging patients, and therefore get accustomed to providing the most expensive and high-tech services. Yet after they graduate, after they finish their residencies and they go into private practice, most of the patients that they see are nowhere near as sick as what they're used to. They don't need such fancy treatment. Low-tech, low-cost treatment would serve the patient much better and would be much cheaper. This is one of the reasons that the Affordable Care Act calls for moving training out of hospitals into local centers so that you don't acclimatize doctors to doing the wrong thing. Don't get me wrong, doctors have to know how to do the high-tech, unusual procedures. But they shouldn't think that every patient who walks into your office requires those high-tech things. One of the ways of restoring that balance is to have doctors practice and learn outside of the tertiary academic medical center. Another unusual cost is the administration of insurance. We spend twice as much as any single-payer country administering insurance payments. Nationally, 7% of all of our $3.5 trillion of medical costs go to administration of insurance. Compare that figure to what Canada spends administering. Administering insurance means reading the documents, collecting the charts, sending out the checks, auditing to make sure everything is going okay. Canada spends 2.6% of their medical expenditures on administration. So more than twice as much as we have to. That's $100 billion that we spend that other countries don't spend. And incidentally, it has nothing to do with whether you're Canada or France or any other country. The United States knows how to spend little on administration. We just have to look at the most efficient deliverers of medical care in the United States. That is the government. Medicare, Medicaid, VA administration, TRICARE, healthcare for military officials, all spend less than 3% on administration. They're the most efficient, cost-conscious deliverers of medical care in the country. Contrary to what you've been told, government can do it right and often does better than private competitive businesses. The biggest single expense in medical care, 31% of that $2.7 trillion, goes for hospital care. And that's why the Affordable Care Act, the other reason why the Affordable Care Act wants to move as much medicine as possible, as much treatment as possible, as much training as possible, out of the hospitals, into community settings, and even into the private home. And the Affordable Care Act, we don't have time to go into it, has dozens and dozens of provisions for how to do this. The second problem, quality. For all that money that we're spending, we're buying second-rate care. We're far from number one. In fact, on the OECD aggregate measure of health for all the advanced industrial countries, about three dozen of them, we rank near the bottom. For example, we are 12th in life expectancy at birth. We're 39th of all the 200 countries in the world. We're 39th in infant mortality. We rank just above Poland, a very uncomforting thought to me. We have 6,200 deaths per million births per year in the United States. France has 3,300 deaths per million births. We have twice as many deaths as France does, infants. We are killing 10,000 babies a year that we don't have to because we have such a bad healthcare system, a healthcare system that other countries do much better at. Don't get me wrong, if you're Romney, you don't have to worry about losing children in childbirth. It's only the rest of us, 47%, who have to worry. Incidentally, you might think, it's all those blacks and Hispanics who are messing up our data. The death rate for white babies in the United States is 5,600 per million white births. So even then, we're worse than France, Canada, Germany, England, New Zealand, Australia. You can reel off all the countries that we would like to think ourselves as comparable to. It's no big secret, incidentally. You've been not told this by people who have a vested interest in not pointing this out to you. It's embarrassing. And not only embarrassing, it's immoral, because I really don't see much difference between outright murder and having a medical care system that you could reform but don't reform that kills so many babies. The third problem is access. There are about 50 million uninsured people right now. We think of the uninsured as a bunch of lazy bums sitting around refusing to get a job. 80% of the uninsured people are in working families, most of whom were not offered insurance by their boss. McDonald's, Walmart, the local clothing store, a clerk here or there, all the low-paying jobs in the United States, many of them don't offer health care. The big companies do, except, of course, the Walmarts and so on. Two-thirds of the people who are uninsured make less than twice the poverty level. Less than a tenth of the uninsured are undocumented immigrants. A second part of the access problem is that there are so many underinsured people, people whose insurance does not cover catastrophic expenses or covers a pitiful percentage of a catastrophic expense so that they can't afford to pay it. The best measure of this is bankruptcies. In the year 2007, the last year we have accurate data, there were 1 million bankruptcies in the United States. Two-thirds of them were precipitated by medical bills. A third access problem is difficulty even getting to see a doctor. Compared to the socialized medicine delivered in the UK, there are four times as many Americans who skip a doctor visit, a medical test, or fail to fulfill a prescription because of the cost. A third more people in the United States than in the UK can't get a doctor's appointment the same or the next day. Twice as many people in the United States as in socialized medicine UK can't get medical care on nights or weekends without going to the emergency room. Such access problems are immoral for two reasons. They cause unnecessary suffering, and they deny equal treatment and equal opportunity to people merely because they're poor. 5 minutes? The fourth problem is fairness. The financing of healthcare raises a fairness issue. It's regressive in that the sick and the poor pay a larger percentage of their income than the rich and the healthy. We've built this into the structure of our system, which is insurance. The job of private insurance companies, where most Americans get their coverage, is, quote, underwriting, that is, rating each customer and charging more if he has a greater chance of using his insurance. This is modeled on life insurance, where companies will charge more to insure me, 70-year-old man, than you, a 22-year-old person. Obviously, I have a greater chance of dropping dead than you do. As in fire insurance or property insurance, the little piggy who wants to insure the house that he just built out of straw expects to pay more than his brother piggy who built a house out of brick. And that seems, again, as with life insurance, fair. But health is not the same kind of commodity, and actuarial fairness is not moral fairness. What the purchaser wants is not payment to compensate him for his loss, but an intervention to prevent him from metaphorically burning to the ground. In short, he wants the equivalent of a fire department who will respond at the first flame and put out the fire. And surely we would think it unfair for people who live in fire-prone slums to pay higher taxes for the city's fire department than those who live in rich neighborhoods like Fifth Avenue, which are less likely to burn down. We recognize that fire can strike rich as well as poor, and we feel enough social solidarity to agree that, if anything, the rich should pay more than the poor for the same protection. Not to mention, we fear that our house might not escape if the fire in another neighborhood burns out of control. And so we recognize that it's also in our self-interest to pay for putting out other people's fires. When it comes to infectious diseases like flu or TB or AIDS, we sometimes have that same attitude. But it's rare for us to generalize to other areas of health. The reformers tell us that it is in our own prudent self-interest to do so. They tell us that no man is an island, that we exist only as members of families and communities, and that, as Hume said, we therefore have a natural feeling of sympathy for our fellows and see their well-being as bound up with our own. And so we should not have to rely on charity or on optional supererogatory impulses of altruism, as our modern conservatives assert. But in the United States, we have two competing myths of the way to live. The mythic cowboy, the lone ranger, the Shane, the ruggedly independent individual, versus the mythical small town community, where everyone pitches in for the barn raising to help the farmer whose barn has just burned down, knowing that one day he might need similar help himself. Much of the debate on healthcare reform sounds like these two myths of individual autonomy versus social solidarity competing for the soul of our country. And we can all be proud that the passage of Obamacare and the re-election of the president who promised to continue it showed that our better selves won.
A couple of questions, so you just go ahead and call whoever you think you want to answer a question.
Yeah, okay. Any questions?
In the back.
In the back.
Okay. One of the things that's happened that has not been addressed from what I know, which is the cost that the government's going to have to do at this moment after accepting so many new people into their coverage plan that obviously is a tremendous cost, not only the government, the economy as a whole.
Right.
Currently, as we all know, the economy is not where we'd like it to be, and it's struggling to stay afloat. How can you ethically, say it's okay that at the risk of the rest of the country, the rest of the economy, where yes, we have issues with the healthcare, okay? Nobody here is saying that what we have before is perfect. That's definitely not true, or good necessarily. But is it ethically okay to bring down the rest of the country in the sense that it's going to be something which will choke the economy because new jobs are definitely increased in tax, increases on paying for
So it would be unethical to suggest that at this time we should increase our economic expenses just to save 10,000 babies. I agree, that would be unethical. That's actually exactly what Romney proposed to do. The Affordable Care Act, it's funny, everybody says it's so complicated. It's not all that complicated. It just requires that you read a few things and know a little bit of math. The Affordable Care Act is about $1 trillion of expenditures. Most of that is going to go to get about 32 million people who are currently uninsured, either enrolled in Medicaid, which the government has promised to pay 100% of the Medicaid enrollment for the first few years, 90% forever, as opposed to only 50% federal contribution to Medicaid, requiring a 50% state match of every other Medicaid thing. So to pay for enrolling 16 million people in Medicaid and to pay for subsidizing the purchase of private insurance by another 16 million people, that's going to cost about $800 or $900 billion. Where is that money going to come from, you say? Well, the Affordable Care Act increases taxes. It has a tax on people whose income comes from stock sales, people who have unearned income, who currently are paying ridiculously low rates, have a special 3.8% tax on any unearned income over $200,000 a year, not the first $200,000, any income over $200,000 a year. That's going to be a few $100 billion brought into the country. Medicare, the Medicare tax is going to increase 0.9%. on everybody. There are other features of the act which will bring in new revenue. The major new revenue is savings. About $500 billion is going to be saved by not subsidizing Cadillac insurance policies, by not subsidizing private Medicare Advantage plans. Medicare Advantage is weird. The conservatives said, you know, government is so inefficient, if only we introduced competition with private people, we could get cheaper insurance. It turns out that private insurance companies refused to sell Medicare at the price Medicare is charging. They said, no, it's going to cost us 10% more than the government. The government said, well, private enterprise is what the country is all about, so even though private enterprise is 10% less efficient than the government, let's pay them that 10% extra to subsidize Medicare Advantage, just so we can say, I mean, I'm being a little facetious, not just so that we can say private enterprise is worth. The point is, we've already experimented with having private enterprise provide the same coverage as Medicare, and it failed. Private enterprise failed, but we decided to subsidize it because we've had a whole slew of very conservative governments who have this knee-jerk response to government versus private. Okay, so there's a lot of money coming in from Medicare. The Congressional Budget Office, which everybody recognizes as objective, has examined the projections of how much it's going to cost and how much money is going to come in from new taxes and be saved by a whole bunch of reforms. They say that it's going to cost minus $100 billion. That is, it will save $100 billion. When the Republicans introduced a bill in the House of Representatives to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they asked the Congressional Budget Office to make a report, how much money will the country save by repealing Obamacare? When they came back with the report, it turns out the country will lose $100 billion that we would have saved if you repeal it. So the Republicans who say, let's repeal Obamacare because we can't afford it now, are in effect saying, let's take on $100 billion of extra debt because we hate Obamacare. So the point that you're making is exactly the opposite of the reality. Now, some Republicans say, hey, it's just the Congressional Budget Office. Who believes what they say? This is just mind-boggling. The Congressional Budget Office has a 100% accurate record in predicting the actual cost of every major medical bill that's passed in the United States for the last 70 years. Suddenly, Obamacare is the one thing that they can't predict. It's a it's a nonpartisan government office which is highly respected by everybody. The only people who don't respect it are those who are opposed to Obamacare. So the question that you raise is I think very accurate, but the answer is surprising. Other question? Yeah.
How is it ethical to force people that have insurance?
In fact, Obamacare does not force anybody to do anything.
To penalize you for not.
Penalties are generally accepted as a normal feature of government. If you are on a deserted street in the middle of nowhere and there's a 40 mile an hour speed limit posted and you decide that you're going to go 50 because it's 2 o'clock in the morning and there isn't a car in sight and you didn't notice the police car who's got to make his quota and he gives you a ticket, you've been penalized for breaking the law. In fact, it's not even as bad as that. If you refuse to buy insurance, you have not broken the law. You're not subject to any civil penalties. If you speed, you're subject to the civil penalty of having your license revoked, having points added to it, your insurance premiums go. None of that happens. You pay a fine, and the fine is ridiculously small. One of the things that liberals are upset with about Obamacare is it's not a big enough fine. $700 a year, or 1% going up to 2% of your income, with a cap at a $100,000 income. So the maximum fine anybody is going to pay is $2,000 per family if they refuse to buy health care insurance. And if you're a libertarian who doesn't like the government telling you what to do and you normally go 80 miles an hour in a 40-mile zone, many people speed saying, I don't believe in speed limits and I'll pay the ticket. And if you don't believe in health care reform, pay the penalty. But the idea that this is an infringement on your liberty, the whole country has decided to do something, and there are people who refuse to pay their taxes because they didn't believe that the war that we're fighting was justified. So, I mean, there it's a criminal violation. You go to jail. Here it's just a fine. It's no big, there's zero penalty, and the government has provided zero funds for tracking down people who don't pay it. It's like, we don't realize what a great country we have sometimes. The United States is one of the few countries in the world where everybody pays their taxes. This is unheard of. Everybody cheats everywhere else. In the United States, the only people who cheat are the Romneys of the world. The multimillionaires can hire lawyers and they cheat. Schnooks like you and me, we fill out our tax. Who forces us to fill out our taxes? We don't even know what the penalty is if we don't fill out our taxes. We figure we're citizens of the country, we owe the money, we figure out, we read the book, or we go to HR Block or whatever, and we pay whatever it's supposed to be. Well, what are we, like sheep to the slaughter? No, we're good citizens who do what we're supposed to. And therefore, the idea that Republican conservatives have that there's going to be this mass refusal to pay and it'll never work because this is nonsense. The law's the law. It passed. I mean, it wasn't, Hitler taking over the Reichstag and pushing through some Obamacare law that he's ramming down on everybody. It was passed by regular, normal procedures, 60 votes out of 100 in the Senate. I mean, what more do you want? It's a standard law. Of course people are going to obey it. And even, the Medicaid, the enrollment, the expansion of Medicaid, the Supreme Court said this is voluntary. So originally Obamacare said if you don't expand Medicaid to cover real poor people, that is not just pregnant, disabled, and elderly, but real poor people, then we're going to take away the rest of the Medicaid. The Supreme Court said, no, you're not allowed to have that. So every state is allowed to refuse to accept. And there are many states who are going to refuse, but nobody was forced to accept the original Medicare. Arizona did not accept Medicare. Medicare was passed in 1966 as a law. It was only in, 1978 that Arizona decided to join the Medicare system. And many states sort of dribbled in. So the fact that half the states haven't set up insurance exchanges, have decided that they're not going to go along with the reform, the reform isn't dictatorial. You're allowed. Nobody's forcing you. You want to give up billions of dollars from the federal government? Abigusund, go ahead. And eventually you'll realize, calmer heads will prevail, and you'll realize that, hey, we can benefit from this. The citizens of my state, they also get sick. They could use a little help. Right? Okay. Some other question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last one.
Oh, last one.
How in fact and principle Medicare be able to implement a system where doctors are paid on patient outcomes?
I'm sorry.
How would Medicare be able to implement a system where doctors are paid based on patient outcomes?
That's one of the few governmental fiats where a dictatorial central government took over. The Affordable Care Act said that Medicaid now is half state, half federal government. Each state can decide how much they want to pay doctors for accepting Medicaid patients. Many states, New York incidentally is one of the worst, New York pays Medicaid doctors 50% for Medicaid patients as it does for Medicare patients. The Affordable Care Act says the federal government will make up that difference on the new people. So the federal government, through the Affordable Care Act, is saying we're changing the payment schedule by simply paying it, whatever the state, some states, you know, pay ridiculous amounts, 20-30% for Medicaid. The federal government is now paying 100% of what Medicare pays for Medicaid patients out of its own pocket. The Congressional Budget Office knows this. It's a bunch of very intelligent economists. They've done projections. They know their math. And they said it all works. Yeah. Oh, no more questions. I still have to go the other side. Oh.
You think you got it, then?
What?
Okay.
So let me just... how much? Okay. When do I have until I have 15 more minutes? No, I'm asking. Not okay. Not to be pushy, but
I think we just forgot to give Dr. Halloran a chance for questions. So, in fact,
should we take a break?
No, why don't we just field as if you guys have questions for me as well?
We'll just jump in.
Just jump in whenever.
Okay.
Was your question directed more at me in terms of how so? So with the way that the federal government with so for instance like the accountable care organizations are the main way that the government is deciding to pay for value rather than volume. It's not necessarily something that I guess that they necessarily had to ask our permission to decide. They just basically that was you know something they decided to do. They're the ones paying the bill, and they decided that instead of necessarily reimbursing physicians for just having doing a procedure, they wanted to see outcomes improve. It's a little bit sort of like a game to say, can you get better? Can you get better compared to these hospitals? Can you get better compared to what Professor Leather was saying about the other countries? Essentially, they're trying to do a better job of bringing a patient into the system, getting them better, and getting them out both in a timely fashion and in improving their health instead of necessarily just doing it in a numbers game. You know, it used to be that if someone came with arthritis, you would just get them an injection in their knee and send them out, and you bill for your injection. And you didn't really care if they got better. In fact, it might be better that they didn't, because then they come back to you 3 months later and you inject them again. This the way they're paying now is they want to say, well, what are you doing? Do you have a comprehensive plan for how to get this patient to feel better, to not have to come back to you for another injection and another injection? It's really sort of a challenge for physicians and everyone in the healthcare field to figure out how to make care.
Let me just footnote here. Don't get the wrong impression. Doctors actually, by and large, are among the most moral people in the professional world. There aren't a great many doctors who want you to come back because their first injection didn't work just to, you know, build up volume because they can bill for it. Doctors wish to cure you. The problem is incentives. If you set up certain economic payment structures, you incentivize bad behavior. And what we want to do is incentivize good behavior. Right now, since the doctor gets paid, even if he's incompetent, he has less incentive to examine his practice, to improve his competence, to coordinate with other people. It's that incentivizing of the right thing that an accountable care organization does. And the standard feature is by bundling. Instead of giving a payment for each procedure, you give a flat payment. If you've got kidney stones, $5,000 covers the doctor visits, covers the surgery, covers follow-up and everything. And if you need a second surgery because the first surgery wasn't good, you don't get any more money. Flat $5,000. So most surgeries go great, and $5,000 pays plenty for it. If you mess up, which you're going to, you have to eat it yourself rather than bill anybody. That's sort of the idea behind accountable care organizations. I'm sorry.
No. And like you're saying, it might push you to improve your technique. Let's say you're doing it one way, and you have an error rate of 1%. Why not get it to 0.5%? See if you're something you can do differently. You read your literature, you look at what other positions are doing, and you try to sort of push that envelope. And that's how it's how a lot of healthcare advancement has happened in the country, is by looking to see if you can get better. And so.
And then these incentivized procedures that are inherently risky or inherently need to be done multiple times, there is
a concern with that, and you know, and some of what we were talking about in terms of big academic medical centers, a lot of the really risky procedures are really done actually for not a lot of remuneration. These are procedures that are taking place. You know, Johns Hopkins is doing hand transplants. They lose $30,000 every time they do a hand transplant. They're not actually making any money. They're doing it for basically to push the limits and for a little bit of just sort of fame. I mean, they want to be known as the center that can do hand transplants. And so I think that the experimental stuff is still going to happen. You know, a lot of people think, just as an aside, that they think that because something gets more government control, the private industry is involved, that somehow innovation is not going to happen. And we see that in the military, which is about as socialized as you can be, the innovation still happens. I mean, it's not necessarily that I want to point out that we innovate well in terms of war-making equipment, but the United States still innovates in war-making equipment, and we innovate through government payments to private companies. And it's not something that necessarily that means that they're not, you know, they know how much they're going to make. They know that they don't have to push the limits. So,
and a lot of money is wasted with high-tech medicine. Let me give one example: prostate cancer. Every man has prostate cancer when he reaches a certain age. Almost every, not really, 99% of people have prostate cancer. Almost everybody dies with prostate cancer. Hardly anybody dies from prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is a rather benign, slow-growing cancer, almost always. Unfortunately, we don't know the difference of when it's really a malignant cancer or a fast-growing one and when it isn't. Most people who are diagnosed with prostate cancer shouldn't be treated. There have been many statistical studies showing that watchful waiting, that is getting regular checkups, is the most efficient way of treating early prostate cancer. And yet, we have all these high-tech methods of doing treatment for prostate cancer. Someone just invented the Da Vinci robot to do robot surgery on your prostate gland, supposedly because it's better than regular surgery in not having the side effect of impotence and incontinence. Why are you even doing this high-tech thing since hardly anybody needs surgery? The same with radiation therapy and so on. What the Affordable Care Act does is it says, let's study the issue. Let's give a few $100 million to do comparative studies of what works and what doesn't work, not because we want to save money by letting someone die of prostate cancer, but rather that we want to avoid creating impotence in tens of thousands of men unnecessarily, and having the side effects of surgery or of radiation treatment that are unnecessary. And these are knowable things. So it incentivizes gathering information to decide what to do, rather than saying, what's the highest tech solution to this, whether or not we need it or not? Yeah?
So assuming, like you said, that most medical professionals, I hope to be one someday, are ethical, some of the most ethical and moral professionals around.
Compared to lawyers, teachers, any other profession, yes.
Used car salesman.
The rest of my family.
Rats.
The idea of taking away responsibility for the choices of what to put the patient through from these ethically moral professionals, putting it in the hands of bureaucrats and hospital administrators, in terms of this will get us an incentive from the government, this will not. This is how we're going to tell you to work your office, this is how we're not going to tell you to work your office. You work for, and it, as you probably know that more than I do, private doctors are on the way out, and group practices in hospitals are the way in. So more administration, more telling doctors how to run the practices. So this, it seems like, let's say you have patients. We're talking about the Da Vinci. Okay, how many people actually have used the Da Vinci? Speaking on common disorders, this makes sense. On the common cold, you don't want to spend $1,000 on a full CT scan on someone who has the common cold. But what about those who have, like was mentioned before, let's say some sort of arthritic type of disorder that's uncommon, that is used, experimental drugs are used, sometimes with good effects and sometimes not,
yeah.
But because it's so specific on the individual, and we don't know as much as we would like to about this disorder or about the specific person and what even disorder they have, I feel like the doctor will lose his control.
And you're right. The fear
to do what is important.
Right. You're fearing an uneducated bureaucrat telling a doctor who is both educated and knows his patient what to do, and that's immoral.
Not even that. Sometimes
an educated
bureaucrat,
but a bureaucrat
who knows what to do.
A faceless bureaucrat telling the doctor what to do.
And
that's exactly the situation we have now. Most people get their medical insurance through private insurers. Private insurers hire high school graduates to go through the requests for payment and tell the doctor whether he's allowed or not allowed to do it. So it isn't that where this free group of doctors who do whatever we think is best for our patients, and suddenly this faceless bureaucracy of a government is coming in to tell them. That's the system we're getting rid of. That's the system that by having professional, educated people, the appropriate people, doctors, people who have studied at academic medical centers who do research, they're going to do the research to find out what works and doesn't work, and nobody's going to tell the doctor you can't do a C-section, you can't operate on this prostate cancer. They're simply going to establish guidelines, practice parameters, that the doctor will be free to practice whatever he wants, but he will know that if he's very far outside of the practice parameters, perhaps he's not practicing good medicine. Take C-sections, for example. Every doctor says, this woman needed a C-section. Well, we know that there are some cities where one city has 30% of women have C-sections. A city 50 miles away has 15% of the women with C-sections. Is there something in the water that's causing the women in the other city to have more difficult births, that they can't have a vaginal birth? That's ridiculous. It couldn't possibly be. It must be that the doctors in one city simply do unnecessary C-sections. Well, each individual C-section, nobody's going to tell you do this or not, but somebody perhaps should tell the doctors, you know something, you're doing twice as many C-sections as everybody else. Look within yourself and see, perhaps you're not diagnosing this woman properly. Perhaps you haven't trained yourself well in forceps delivery, which is the standard way of avoiding C-sections. Hardly anybody learns how to deliver by forceps. If the baby is in the wrong position, so you stick the forceps in and you twist the head around. Everybody did this 50 years ago. Nobody does it now. How come? Because they're bad doctors. Bad doctors. They're good doctors, but they were poorly trained because nobody incentivized them to try and to learn and to be aware of the lower tech way of avoiding the much more dangerous C-section. People die of C-sections. It's major surgery. So the Affordable Care Act does not tell you what to do. It establishes standards for what good practice should be, which incidentally every professional medical organization has already been doing for years, establishing practice standards. This simply creates a source of funding and a source of coordination of those practice standards through the Affordable Care Act.
So if you go back, you're speaking about, I assume, a breech birth where the doctor would rather do a C-section than a natural birth. From what I've heard, from my experience, it seems that most of the time, like most of the time, all the time, because you'll rarely ever find a doctor who's willing to actually go in and not do a C-section.
That's the problem.
It's because of the issue of lawsuits if they mess up.
Right.
Now, is there any reason that I should assume that the government will back
I'm glad you asked that question. There is, and the Affordable Care Act has the answer once again. Part of the Affordable Care Act funds research in alternatives to lawsuits for bad outcomes. $3 million was just given to a coalition of New York City judges to establish a mediation group for New York City obstetricians and gynecologists to decide on suits for babies who were born with various defects that supposedly were caused by the incompetence of the doctor.
That's all well, but let's say you're an OBGYN, you're paying $50,000, you're paying the most that anybody pays for
exactly, right.
For insurance, malpractice.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, you can't do C-sections on all these patients, so you have to do...
No, you can do them. No, but No, you're going
to
get...
You're not going to be able to pay for them, so you have to pay...
Okay, the Affordable Care Act does not specify what kind of incentives and disincentives will exist.
This OBGYN is going to be
right.
Making a lot of money.
So what are we, okay, so what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We know that half of the C-sections that are performed, perhaps, are done defensively. That the doctor is doing it because, to quote the cliche, nobody ever got sued for not doing a C-section, right? So better to do a C-section. So you cut up the poor woman; she can never have a vaginal birth again. It's her body. I don't want to be sued, right? So that's okay. That's the system we. So who's going to do anything about this? The Affordable Care Act at least establishes demonstration projects. It gives money and funding for people to figure out different ways of solving the problem. You see, what's great about the Affordable Care Act is it's not an arrogant imposition by some dictator or socialist, I know the answer. In effect, Obama says, I don't know the answer. There's hundreds of problems. There's thousands of possible solutions. Here's a few hundred million dollars, a few dozens of billions of dollars to figure out what the solutions are. There have been over 2,000 grants that have been given out in the last 2 years by the Affordable Care Act to local, some of them private, some of them public, some of them hospitals, some of them private health services, centers, to experiment around with different ways of solving everything. Not everything, whoever applied. In fact, there were 6 people in the country who applied to have various solutions to the problem of doctors being sued. So there's 6 different, right now, approaches to ending that problem. Should we end it? Of course. No doctor should have to be afraid of being sued. Maybe the answer is to have the government be the insurer, so you don't have to buy private insurance. The government will pay every doctor to be insured. If you're licensed, we assume that you act appropriately. Cheaper for the government to simply handle every payment for medical liability than to leave it up to the individual doctor to negotiate with the insurance company, which is charging him an arm and a leg. Nobody else besides Obamacare is even trying to solve it. And the fact that it doesn't specify this is the solution, that's the strength of the act, not the weakness.
Okay,
thank you so much.
As a quick aside to that, so with government insurance, so the original Medicare, Medicaid, I find personally that it's much easier to deal with getting things approved. The government insurance, we generally operate within the realms of what evidence-based medicine, and I have very little difficulty getting things approved for my Medicare patients, for my Medicaid patients. The people I have difficulty getting approved for are the private insurance and the Medicare Advantage, the ones where it's been privatized. You often get on the phone with people, and not again, I mean, I'm from an Irish background, half my family is uneducated. It's nothing against uneducated people, but I'm spelling medical procedures to the high school graduate that's on the phone with me trying to explain why this should be authorized, and it's with private insurance. And so, and that doesn't happen with Medicare, it just really doesn't.
Okay. If there are any questions, we'll take them at the end. Our last, but certainly not least, speaker is Rabbi Yosef Blau. Rabbi Blau is the senior Mashgiach Rukhani here at Yeshiva, and he's been teaching and guiding students and communities for many years. Rabbi Blau received his MS from Yeshiva University and his Smicha from Ritz. Rabbi Blau is going to present us with a halachic perspective on public health.
It's been a long program, and some have had to leave. But I'll be able to help in that regard. Because, frankly, there is very little halachic material on the questions that we've been discussing. Just realize, give it, you know, context. When you go through the discussions in the Gemara, in the Poskim, about helping people in need, so there's, of course, in discussions of tzedakah, of charity, there's a great deal of discussion of people who don't have food to eat, of proper clothing to wear, but there's really no discussion of people who don't have proper medical care. And the reason for that is that the overwhelming majority of these swarm, these books, were written when preventive medical care was simply not understood at all. Doctors, with, to put it mildly, not very efficient in providing medical care. So you have, yes, rapoy rapay, you have permission for doctors to cure. We don't, it's not infringing on the role of Kadosh Baruch Hu, of God. We know that if I damage somebody else, one of the things I have to pay is his medical bills. But that's very individual and very specific and limited. So that's not going to help us directly. Interestingly, in Israel, which has a form of socialized medicine, and I've tried to look through the literature, and I don't find any of the halakhic authorities in Israel having any problem with it. So that doesn't help me there either. We'll spend some time, because I don't want to do nothing up here and saying that it's all taken care of, in discussing the issue of private charity and public charity, because that is really comparable. You know, let's assume that if they would have known that one of the roles to be played in helping people with medical care, they would have treated it in a similar fashion to dealing with people who have no food to eat or don't make a decent living, because the criteria for charity is a income below a certain level in general. Poverty, how one deals with it is the question. Some say, well, look, the religious system is one of private charity, of relying on people giving from their goodwill, encouraging them to do so, you know, stressing how important charity is as a value, and there's a great deal of truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. Right? If you go, say, in Rambam and Maimonides, and look up Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, the story of what we provided for the poor, and there are certain parts which people leaving over from the field where the poor have to come sort of and take their share. But in charity, the section on charity, so we find the following. Yes, people should give individually. If they do not do so, the local government is able to force people to give charity. Kofin al tzedakah, you can force them. We find in communities, and remember, a second point I should have pointed out, we don't have the same notions of government that we have today. So the issue of what should be done by state government, local government, federal government, assumes American society, right, and all these different levels of government to exist in the first place. But so most things they're talking about were local, right, the community. And there's a whole, you know, question of how long one had to live in the community to take on various obligations of providing for needs of the community. That's discussed in the Gemara in Baba Basra. And it's also a process of giving out. There's a food kitchen, right? There's a weekly giving and a daily giving. And the coupon, the tamchui, too. And money, funds were collected from it, and there were individuals chosen representing the community to distribute the food and to collect, which implies, number one, some kind of supervision to make sure that people didn't ask for charity who didn't deserve it, right, that didn't meet the criteria, and number two, some means of enforcing from people who didn't give their share to make them do so. It may seem to you less sophisticated than a modern system, but we're talking about a relatively small community, and there were very high standards for who would be eligible to play the role as the Gabbai Tzedaka, and I guess it wouldn't be any old faceless bureaucrat. It would have to be somebody who is highly respected in the community. But even then, we see some kind of balance between individual giving and community demands and a community setting standards for it. The highest form of charity, according to Maimonides, of course, is to help someone so they don't need the charity, which I think in the medical, you know, corresponds to preventive medicine rather than paying the bills, trying to, as much as possible, prevent people from needing the bills in the first place. And so the only question then becomes, what is a more effective means of promoting preventive medicine? Is it a system with a government involvement, or is it a system done by private doctors on their own, all of whom realize that the benefit is long range and not immediate. In other words, treating conditions is something a doctor gets paid for. Whatever system you're going to have, setting up proper means of preventive medicine is harder to, you know, quantify and to work out. And I'm not going to give you the answer to that. You've heard presentations of people who feel that the governmental approach is more effective, but that's not a halakhic issue, you know. The halakha doesn't tell us what system is more effective. Now, that's not really within the realm of halakha. I believe that the halakha, just like it shows concern that everybody have a minimal amount of food to eat on the table and clothing to wear and be protected, given the ability in society to provide medical care, would similarly set up some kind of requirement to ensure that everybody gets that minimal medical care. As I said, I can't prove it from the early sources simply because it wasn't possible at the time. Again, refer back to the fact that in Israel, where you have this kind of system, I don't find any halakhic authorities having difficulty with it. I'm not going to be able to, you know, go through every single, you know, I wrote copious notes of all the provisions to say if halacha would see that as the best way of doing it or not. I'm not too sure whether halacha would frankly have an opinion about that. The issues taking away from the freedom of the doctors to make decisions, which I think were implied by a number of the questions, and I think it's a real concern that doctors have. I have enough doctors in my wife's family, you know, who've been worrying for years and years about socialized medicine taking away their income. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a doctor, so it doesn't affect me. So it's easy for me to say that their fears are overblown, because I don't have the fear. And there's no way the government's going to pay rabbi salaries, so it's not going to make a difference. It's hard for me to answer. There are more halakhic sources to talk about concern of arrogant doctors than poorly paid ones. Certainly, the Talmud assumes that a doctor should be paid, and that a doctor who doesn't get paid is worth the non-salary that he gets. How high a salary doctors should get, I don't think that's been adequately pursued, in halakhic sources. It would be nice for me to give you a deeper halakhic analysis. I'm not sure that there's one to be given, frankly, at this point. I find it fascinating, though I can't really explain it, that while in Israel we don't find in the rabbinic community a great deal of concern about this, there's a Haredi or ultra-Orthodox deputy minister of health who in effect really runs the Ministry of Health that has to do with Israeli religious politics, why it's structured this way. And he certainly hasn't brought up once, changing the system to reduce the governmental involvement in it. And at the same time, if you read, which I don't read regularly, some of the Haredi newspapers in America, they're of the strongest opponents of Obamacare, and they seem to see it as a real problem. I just don't get their halakhic arguments. It may be my predispositions that operate, but I just don't get it. But I'd be happy to answer any questions on what little I said.
Is there anything to say on the difference between our obligations towards preventative medicine and emergency care, or preventive medicine, emergency care, and care improvement, such as an operation to help someone use a leg again, like they used to?
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine. It's hard for me to imagine that the concern for the physical welfare of people should be limited only to the extreme, right? Only to ensure that everybody gets some medical care, right? Some minimal level of medical care, which would require more than Obamacare provides. To do that which is best practice to ensure in the society as a whole in the long run that people live longer and have better medical care. It's hard for me to see a strong differential.
Let's take Dr. Avenger's example of in the present situation, we have 3,000 unnecessary infant deaths.
Right.
And the hope is to lower that number, right?
Well, a single life, there we're touching on something where we could go into halacha. I just don't think it depends on this system or another. And that is, there are real issues in terms of having machinery that can save lives, but are not available for everyone, right? And establishing priorities, who gets on the dialysis machine, who gets the kidney transplant, these kind of questions are real questions, and that we do have, some halakhic literature, but I don't think that really depends on the system, that's another kind of question.
Let me complicate the question and ask for the halakhic response to it. In fact, we actually have a pretty good idea of why we have 10,000 excess baby deaths in the first year. It probably has to do with poor prenatal and postnatal care. Right now, we have no system to ensure that every pregnant woman has prenatal care, the way England, for example, does. We have no system to follow a mother after she goes home with her baby. In Canada and England, that mother is called every few days to see how are things going, do you need some help, is visited, do you know how to bathe them, do you know how to change the diaper, and so on. These things presumably help. Now, these are in the form of preventive measures. They're not technical innovations. They're hands-on things. They don't require a doctor. They do require a nurse practitioner, a social worker, a midwife, a lactation consultant to go. Babies who breastfeed live longer or have a better survival rate than babies who don't. Doesn't that mean that we have an obligation to encourage breastfeeding? And if we do have that obligation, shouldn't we pay for a lactation consultant and pay for a nurse practitioner to call to find out if you need a lactation consultant, rather than just dumping this poor mother out in the cold? I would think that there might be a holistic obligation.
Right. Now, I should have pointed out, before I get to the next question, two things. Because of the major role that medical insurance already plays in the system, right? So we're not really contrasting the doctor simply making all the decisions with government making decisions, because we have the role of the insurance company making a decision, and I'm personally aware, and obviously arguing by anecdote is terrible. Terrible means of proving anything whatsoever. You can get an anecdote to prove anything. Of a situation of someone in a hospital where the hospital wouldn't release the patient because they felt the patient had to stay a few days longer, and the insurance company just said, no, we stop paying now. We stop paying because we decided that the patient doesn't need to be in the hospital any longer. And this, it happened, in a case that I knew about quite recently. So the freedom of the hospital and the doctors to make their own decisions is somewhat affected now by an outside source. I'm not going to get into debate, which one's going to get better outside sources, but it's not anymore, the doctor's simply doing what the doctor thinks should be done. I just imagine anyone in hospital care without medical insurance, the bills for hospital care simply assume it's medical insurance, because there's no way, except for an extremely wealthy person, to possibly pay it out of pocket. In fact, it's getting funny because the medical insurance companies bargain with the hospitals. So they don't pay the rate that they're supposed to pay. And there are doctors in the hospital now trying, I believe it's not legal, but they're trying, to send bills to patients for the difference. Right? And, having gone through a minor medical procedure, every procedure has anesthesiologist involved. I thought everything was taken with the doctor, and sure enough, I got a bill from the anesthesiologist. When I called my insurance company and they told me, don't pay it, we'll take care of it. But if I didn't know to call my insurance company, I would have, Because it's a complicated business. Yeah, let's get one or two more people. Yeah.
This may not be strictly halakhic, maybe more something that would be a shkafa or something in that realm, which is a lot of the discussion that gets here, which is healthcare a privilege or a right? Meaning, is that a fundamental human right that everybody is entitled to a sense of protection from society or the community, at least in terms of health insurance? Or no, that's a privilege. That's not something which has existed for...
Okay, so that's what I pointed out, that you won't find in halakhic sources discussion of everyone's right to have reasonable health care. But then again, as was Dr. Aharon started in the very beginning, when he's going through history, how many of our halakhic sources were written after the middle of the 19th century? And anything earlier, the concept didn't exist. No. You went to a doctor because you had to do something, but no one had a real read on this, and the best you could get was, Maimonides talking about living a healthy life, right? That's, and be careful of the diet that you eat, right? Now, you could argue, when Maimonides said that, he was giving people halachic judgment, advice, but he didn't demand it of him, and maybe, they would see, Michelle Obama's talking about what kind of food people should eat is more coercive. I don't know. I don't think he's a bigger authority than Maimonides was, but it's a tricky business. I mean, remember, American society, and I think this is a very important point that Professor Venter spoke about, is very committed to the notion of individual freedom. It's a very American notion, and it's a very important notion, not to be dismissed. And anything that's seen as infringing on the freedom of the individual to make all the choices is objected to in American society. I don't believe that halacha has the same concept of freedom. It has a concept of freedom, but it's, If we could have a Talmudic, statement that you're only free if you're committed to Torah. So, I mean, obviously, it's a different notion of freedom that operates. Yeah, one more. Yeah.
There's a lot of discussion regarding standard of living, regarding, for example, when you have two towns or villages next to each other, one has water and the other.
Yeah.
At what point does the village have to give up certain non-necessary
right.
things and provide water for the other village, for example, washing laundry and stuff.
Right.
So could we somehow tie the standard of living to provide healthcare?
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting observation. We just live in a much more integrated world. So it's not so simple to take the examples of these separate towns and the water supply, because everything is so much more interconnected than it was beforehand. And yes, the one area which I didn't go into, and I Samuzukia had to leave, and you can see his article, which I told him I thought was brilliant. I'm not sure it's right, but I thought it was brilliant. When you bring in the notion of chayecha kodmim, that a person, my obligations to others, as great as they are, don't outweigh my obligation to myself. Right? I have a primary obligation, to myself, and then extend it outward to others as well. I definitely have obligations to others, but I don't have to lose, in the classic example of a person in the desert, and he has enough water to drink, and there's someone else with him, and it's his water, to dispute whether he has to share it or not, and run the risk of both dying, and the answer is his life comes first, assuming that's the accepted halachic norm. Most people do. It's not 100% clear in some sources, right? But that's in extremis, right? Do I have to? So if you had a system in which the individual could not get the best care for himself or herself in order to ensure the good of the system, that would become a real issue. I didn't hear anything to indicate that it's moved in that, in that direction, that anybody who had the resources and wanted to get, pay for a certain treatment and whatnot would be restricted from doing so by what was presented, and until it reaches that level, I don't think the issue really comes to play.
I have another question.
Yeah.
I got to think about it because of the cottage cheese. So there was a big dispute in Israel about the boycott of the cottage cheese. I don't know if any of you kind of crossed it. The cottage cheese prices were doubled, And the question is the boycott justified? And the answer, there was a big article in Tehumen that says, yes, it is justified because the government has an obligation to control the price. And it doesn't necessarily have to be what Maimonides said, which is your profit should be no more than 1/6 of the price, but that it should be a government-set price, so that the part of the Affordable Care Act that we didn't talk very much about is the first word, Affordable Care Act. There are many regulations in the Act which say what the maximum that you're allowed to charge for something, the parameters for how much money you can make, which is going to affect your salary. And I think the halacha is fairly clear that this is precisely a government obligation, and that it doesn't, government can have obligations side by side with individual obligations, but that the government should, like the supposed idea that the government should stay back and let the field play by itself is totally anti-halacha.
Okay. I try to avoid getting to this. No, I'll tell you why. You know, it's over the years that I've been interested in these things, as the Orthodox community has moved from being quite liberal to being quite conservative, and that's obviously a generalization. So when I was a young man, there was an assumption that being liberal was consistent with, that's what halacha wanted the society to be. And now the society has become more conservative, it's assumed that being conservative is, and I'm not talking about social issues, I'm talking about economic issues. And I've always felt that trying to fit the halachic economic system into either capitalism or socialism is to miss a lot of the point, right? There are elements in each system which correspond to a certain degree, but it's a system based on, one, the assumption that the world ultimately belongs to God and not to us, right? Therefore, it's not quite, you know, fit into the categories that we'd like everything to fit into using the terminology, which is helpful but overdone, not effective. The question is the role of government, and it's interesting. So this one I was going to say, so I got a chance to get it in now. The Talmud in Bava Kamma discusses 10 decrees of Yeshua, and then 10 degrees of Ezra. Right? It's Perek Meruba, I think it's Dafayin Dalad. So it's interesting, the 10 takanot, right? The 10 decrees of Yeshua, almost all of them are things for the welfare of society, where individual rights and private property are reduced for the good of the community, right? For Yishuv HaAretz, right? So I can't restrict people from going on my property under certain circumstances and times because it's better for society. We'll let the dung of the animals on the ground because people are going to step on it, create fertilizer. It's good for probably forestry, things of that nature. Interesting, the decrees of Ezra are almost all religious in character, right? They have to read the Torah on Mondays and Thursdays things to prevent intermarriage. It's a very different kind of decrees. If you look at when Maimonides discusses the role of the rabbis, right, to expand the Torah. So he talks about, both in his introduction to Mishnah and into Hilchos Mamrim, he discusses three categories, right? Gzeros, Takanos, and Minhagim. And Gzeros are definitely expansions of Torah law, right? Normally think of all the rabbinic prohibitions of work on Shabbos, right? They're expanding what the Torah prohibits in order to prevent one from doing what the Torah prohibits, right? They're very religious in character. Minhagim also tend to be customs of religious nature, but the Takanot, the Rambam sees as the right of the rabbinic authorities, and the whole issue of who should be the government is a, you know, rabbinic government, the king, the secular government is an worthy of a program, not worthy of a throwaway line, is for the welfare of society. You know, things that are seen to be for the welfare of society. How to define what the parameters are, what is the welfare of society, I don't find people doing that. I mean, there's sort of an assumption that we all know what the welfare of society, you know. The best for the most people, you know. The healthiest society, and I'm using, healthy was not used in the medical sense there, right? The society, you know. The notion of certain things done for tikkun olam, certain things done for darkei shalom, right? Means to get a harmonious society, a society that takes care of things. The method of doing that, right? Which I think is the real question, what should be done through government, what should be done through individual enterprise, what should be done on what level of government, are questions that I think are much more within the frame of, you know, American society and not things discussed in traditional halakhic sources. So I'm not sure there's a single halakhic answer.
I think that's it for questions. Thanks everyone for coming, and thank you to our three wonderful speakers. Thank you guys so much.